Hello and welcome to Virtues of Peace. My name is Hope Elizabeth May, and I'm joined by Michael Buzzy and special guest Vanda Praskova, who's joining us from Prague, the Czech Republic, for the third week in a row. Thank you again for being here, Vanda.
Thank you so much for having me for the third time. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, and it's so great to have you repeatedly on this show, because we've been engaged in a dialogue just to catch up our listeners. We began with Vanda a couple of weeks ago talking about Bertha von Suttner. We talk about her often on this show, the first woman to win the Nobel Peace Prize. She inspired Nobel to create the Peace Prize, and she won that in 1905. And Vanda is very busy and engaged in activities aimed at educating her fellow citizens in the Czech Republic about Bertha, because Bertha was born in Prague. So that began our dialogue. And then last week, Vanda also works on youth engagement in the anti-nuclear issue. And we were talking about her work with one of the organizations that she works with called Youth Fusion last week. And just about the, you know, the NGO activity surrounding the nuclear disarmament movement. And today is a very special day because we are on the eve of the historic ratification of the Treaty for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. It enters into force tomorrow, January 22nd, 2021. And we are here to talk about some of the meat of the treaty, some of the articles, as well as some of the language in the preamble, which lays out the letter and spirit of the treaty. So we began to talk about the treaty last week, and we encourage you to listen to our other shows. We also have been talking about the treaty well before this month. So back in August, I think we talked about, and we have a number of shows on the Treaty for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. So just a brief review. Tomorrow, the Treaty for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons enters into force. And if you're not clear as to what that means, it basically means becomes effective. So a number of states have signed this treaty. And when 50 states signed it, the treaty was to go into effect 90 days after the 50th ratification. So that 90-day mark is tomorrow. And so the treaty does take effect tomorrow for the states who have signed it. And I think Vanda is going to talk about what that really means for international law. But let's just begin with the preamble of the Treaty for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. You can download the text of the treaty on our show resources page at virtuesofpeace.com. And we encourage you to read the treaty. It does require quite a bit of study and discussion, and that's why we're here today. So we're beginning with the preamble. And Vanda, if you could just share a remark about the preamble that you think is important to highlight.
Absolutely. So, and again, the treaty is online, so I strongly encourage everyone to read it. But what really stood out to me, and I'm not sure how philosophical this is, but the preamble recognizes the disproportionate impact of nuclear weapon activities on indigenous peoples and the impact of nuclear weapons testing, which that sounds pretty standard, but it's actually very crucial to be recognized. So when countries, when, you know, putting their test sites away from their people, like with France, who did their testing pretty much anywhere but in France, like, for example, they did it in French Polynesia or Africa. It seems when these countries do this, that they're forgetting about the indigenous peoples of those lands. And there's so many examples of this, like in Washington State in the U.S., the Hanford Nuclear Reservation has caused dramatic increases in cancer rates among local indigenous peoples. And it's just not just testing, it's also uranium mining. For example, in Australia, in the Olympic Dams, that's one of the world's largest deposits of uranium, there the miners completely ruined the lands of the Aboriginals that took care of the lands for so long. And a similar story in the Sahara Desert, where France conducted above-ground nuclear tests, but actually never released any information on the contamination or on the people affected. Mm. And my brain is just not comprehending how this is even possible. And then, you know, the list just goes on. China mines uranium at a sacred site in Tibet. So there is a huge environmental aspect of nuclear weapons, not only to humans, which we've also talked about last week, but also to nature. Mm. And there is also a huge cultural impact on the indigenous peoples, which we don't really talk about enough and not know a lot about. Even within the field of nuclear disarmament, you know, we don't talk enough about nuclear colonialism when indigenous tribes have to move from their homelands because of nuclear testings. So what really stood out in the preamble was precisely this, just recognizing that this is an issue and that something that needs to be further promoted and talked about. I think that was one of the biggest things for me.
Yeah, thanks so much for that. And actually, I'm pretty sure if memory serves, when we first began talking about the TPNW, like back in maybe October on this show, we did all like look at the language in the preamble, and I pointed out a very similar clause to yours and that, Sean, I'll just briefly mention it, and then we'll go into Michael's observation about the preamble. But there's also a disproportionate impact on women and girls, and that's also recognized in the preamble. And that was new to me, and that's why I was not aware of that. And as you're saying, Vonda, we just, like, when we're talking about nuclear disarmament, we don't talk about how even the testing disproportionately impacts certain groups of people, as well as women and girls. And so that's language also in the preamble. I just want to draw attention to that. Michael, go ahead with your language from the preamble.
Thank you. And thank you, Vonda. The section of the preamble that talked about the disproportionate effects of nuclear weapons on Indigenous people, that was also one that strongly resonated with me as well. Yeah, the section of the preamble that I selected reads as follows. Concern by the slow pace of nuclear disarmament, the continued reliance on nuclear weapons in military and security concepts, doctrines, and policies, and the waste of economic and human resources on programs for the production, maintenance, and modernization of nuclear weapons. Wow, that is definitely a lot. One of the reasons why this section of the preamble resonated with me so strongly is that and one of the reasons I feel that the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons is so profound is that it attaches these specific value judgments to the whole concept of having nuclear weapons, that it is a waste of economic and human resources, that to put something so constructive and so beautiful, such as the human intellect and the human prowess, into something that can do so much harm and so much destruction to people and the planet as a whole, just seems completely contradictory to what could be done if those efforts were diverted to something more constructive and more beneficial for the whole of humanity. So that was one of the reasons why this section of the preamble really resonated with me. And then also it talks about how that the concept of using nuclear weapons, at least speaking as an individual from the United States, it is so heavily built into most Americans' understanding of what is required for world peace. Many individuals coming out of the Cold War age, that, you know, they see it as it was a balance between we needed to have the same amount of nuclear weapons or more than the Soviet Union. So if anything, no side would then want to act first, because then it would be mutually assured destruction for either side, inevitably then the whole world as a whole. And that fostering an environment of international relations in the 21st century, I do not believe needs to be built around this concept of fear, this concept of annihilation, this concept of that we must dominate instead of working as a global community to better all the problems we face in our current times. And I think this treaty does so much in absolutely changing the discourse and dialogue of what is possible, because I think many individuals in the United States are just not aware that there are other ways to go about fostering peace that does not involve deterrence. It can using more constructive methods, such as dialogue, and using more constructive methods such as dialogue and mutual goals that will ensure all of humanity can advance together instead of just this cloud of fear that, you know, the thing preventing us from annihilating the whole of the planet is knowing that the other side can do the same. And I just felt that it really made me come to understand all the more prowess about this treaty and just changing the very way in which individuals go about understanding and thinking about how the world can function in the 21st century.
May I just add something on this? Please. Just as Michael was speaking, you cited from the treaty and specifically says the slow pace of nuclear disarmament. And I think this is not something completely relevant to the treaty, but just hang on with us. I think it's also why we need to focus on the smaller steps in the whole disarmament process, like to promote no first use. So essentially a policy that would commit to not use nuclear weapons as a means of warfare unless the country is first attacked by an adversary using nuclear weapons. And a fun fact, well, it's not that fun, but up to now, only China recognizes this policy. And India, I think, maintains it with an exception for a response to chemical or biological attacks. But all of the other nuclear powers maintain policies that do permit first use. So implementing no first use policy would be a huge, huge confidence building measure. And it'd make nuclear weapons so much more irrelevant. And this is sadly something that I'm missing. And I don't want to say I'm missing it in the treaty. But it's just in the general ICANN narrative. This is great that we have this treaty, but just to mention that there are other ways to get us at least a bit closer to the goal, and they shouldn't be neglected. But that's just something that, just with the slow pace of nuclear disarmament, popped into my mind.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. And I'll just also add that this point that you made, Michael, about like this is not a way for us to sort of be with each other in the 21st century with policies that are undergirded by fear and annihilation and distrust and so forth. And again, you know, Bertha von Suttner makes that exact point in 1899, and when she's talking about any kind of arms race philosophy or mentality. She says it's something like it's the morality of thieves and bandits, and we're creating an international order based on this sort of, quote, ethos of thieves and bandits, and this is no way to build an international order. And I also think the slow pace of nuclear disarmament, I think that's also a sort of nod to the regime, the non-proliferation treaty regime, which... you know, really was not working from the point of view of non-nuclear weapon states. And we've talked about this on the show that the signatories to the non-proliferation treaty, the nuclear weapon states sort of, you know, pledged to disarm their nuclear arsenals. And they were not doing that. And they were so not doing that the Marshall Islands, as we have discussed, filed a complaint in the International Court of Justice that was dismissed for technical reasons. But so I hope that it comes up in the show later, but just for now, like the non-proliferation treaty regime is being addressed in this treaty. Explicitly it's mentioned, and I think it's this clause, the slow pace of nuclear disarmament. I believe the Non-Proliferation Treaty entered into force in 1970, and we have not really seen disarmament. We've seen actually rearmament and an upgrading of these nuclear weapons systems by the nuclear weapons states. That's a very long discussion, I think, for another several shows, but we'll leave it there for now. And I also want to say that joining us, she was not here when we began, but Taylor Ackerman is also joining us, and welcome, Taylor. It's great to have you here. And you have some preambular language to share.
Yeah, thank you for having me back. The preambular clause that I really stood out to me kind of goes along Michael's same points earlier about how it just seems so contrary to just sort of the idea of humanity and peace in general. And one of the purposes of the United Nations, the main purpose, is international peace and security. And so there's a preambular language that doesn't specifically mention nuclear weapons, but it says, recalling that in accordance with the Charter of the United Nations, states must refrain in their international relations from the threat or use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state or in any other manner inconsistent with the purposes of the United Nations, and that the establishment and maintenance of international peace and security are to be promoted with the least diversion for armaments of the world's human and economic resources. So for me, I mean, I'm just started taking my international humanitarian law class in law school, but to me, it seems shocking that in light of the Charter of the UN, that countries can even threaten through their possession of nuclear weapons, sort of nuclear war. Mm-hmm. And the idea that it's not just the use of weapons, but the threat of the weapons as an illegal act in itself, mm-hmm. really seems important to me. Mm-hmm. Because when you look at what the Charter is saying, it's not just saying there's a use of force, you know, the use of force of is illegal, but the threat of. Mm-hmm. And to me, I know this is debated, but to me, nuclear weapons, the presence of them is a threat in itself, given the arguments for them are usually based on deterrence. And so clearly, as Michael was saying, the use of these weapons, even in a deterrence capacity, goes so contrary to the purposes of the UN that I can't see how it could, it fits with the treaty and or how it fits with the Charter.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really great point that there's like this fundamental contradiction here. Does anybody want to add to that?
Yeah, I think this whole point of security, I think you can just sum it up in a very basic human sense as well. Like, wouldn't you feel more secure locking arms with your fellow man than in a volley of fists? You know, I think the sense of security, having this very toxic and negative and mentally, I would say, exhausting fear that, you know, security needs to be this very outright aggressive thing is, as we've just been saying, and as Taylor was saying as well, it's just very contrary to what, you know, we all envision humanity being. And I think having that mindset of security can be, you can feel secure in fostering relationships and working towards common goals with each other is just fostering a way better environment, and having those values of like kindness and humanity, I think it's a more healthy bed of soil in which to grow and effort than in anger and violence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I'm trying to be positive here. I'd like to believe that this is slowly changing though. And just in light of the pandemic, just to see how our priorities have been shifting really from military security into human security. So I would like to believe that just the general view of how we sense security and how we view it should and is likely to change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think we made this point last week, and I'm going to say it again, that another contributing factor to our shifting view, or should I say evolving view of security, is the political empowerment of women, having women have a political voice, both domestically and internationally, is changing the discourse about security as well. Awesome. My sentence from the preamble is as follows. Considering that any use of nuclear weapons would be contrary to the rules of international law applicable in armed conflict, in particular, the principles and rules of international humanitarian law. And I'm pretty sure, Evanda, you made this point last time that, you know, you talked about the 1996 International Court of Justice advisory opinion, also has in that title the advisory opinion on the legality of the threat. There it is again, the threat or use of nuclear weapons. And in that opinion, the majority of the court said, look, the facts do matter. They do matter in a case that concerns the survival of a state. We're going to reserve judgment here. And to me, you know, some of us have legal training that's a sort of like, this is a fact-driven inquiry, that it all depends on the circumstances. I just want to read like one quick sentence that the United States filed in the International Court of Justice opinion of 1996. So that's 25 years ago, that opinion. The United States, of course, took the position that these weapons are not inherently illegal. And they say something like, whether an attack with nuclear weapons would be disproportionate depends entirely on the circumstances, including the nature of the enemy threat, the importance of destroying the objective, the character, size, and likely effects of the device, and the magnitude of the risk to civilians. And here it comes. Nuclear weapons are not inherently disproportionate. There's something like nothing inherently inhumane. There's nothing that violates humanitarian law inherently about these weapons. That was the view of the United States. I don't know where we're going to go now, but that's not the view of the Treaty for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. I think this is a huge change. And Vonda, you pointed this out last time, that it's categorical. It's like under no circumstances. It's contrary to the rules of international law, and it's contrary to the rules of international humanitarian law. And from philosophy, you know, we make a distinction when we're talking about ethical theories. There's something called utilitarianism, which is like you look at the, you know, the goods, the benefits versus the burdens, and there's a weighing involved. And that's contrasted with the, you know, a Kantian ethic, which is like categorically there are certain things that are wrong no matter what the circumstances are. And this treaty is taking that latter Kantian position, that this is like never legal, and we're going to talk more about it when we get into the articles. But I just think that's really major. And it's also a reason why some states, you know, are not signing on to it, because they see that this is changing the interpretation of the law. I also want to say that, you know, we have on this podcast used the phrase of Shinzo Hamai, the first elected mayor of Hiroshima after the bombing, and he called in his address a revolution of thought, that we have to totally like change our way of thinking. And I think that the clauses that we're pointing out in the preamble are highlighting that we're changing our way of thinking about security, and we're changing our way of thinking about just these weapons, that they are categorically wrong. And for me, to wrap my mind around it, it's like, if you can think of the most horrible act that like we all agree is horrible, like child molesting, it's like, it's just never like, there's no facts and circumstances that are going to make that right. And that's the kind of judgment that's going on in this treaty, that, and that's the sort of value of the treaty, that it's just, it's time to stigmatize these weapons. They are categorically wrong. There's no set of circumstances or facts that could enable them to be justified, et cetera. So that was my sentence in the preamble that stuck out to me. And when we talk about the articles, I think this theme will come up again. I open it up to anybody who wants to comment on that. And if not, we'll go ahead, Vonda.
Yeah, no, you were just touching upon the exact one thing that where I have, I don't want to say an issue with the treaty, but just where I see how it can get very tricky. Because yes, the treaty, thanks to the treaty, we can now say that using nuclear weapons, even in an extreme circumstance of self-defense, is also illegal. But it is also illegal only for the 51 state parties, or the, any state that will accede later. Nice. So my question, and I have absolutely no answer to this, but what do we do with the nuclear powers that have not signed or ratified and will not accede? How do we change the narrative there? And like for that question, the treaty is just not, I don't see a solution there. And I even, if I just may add one thing, it can be even a bit confusing. And that's why I have such mixed feelings about it, because the campaign is creating a bit of a confusion, especially among those who are not well educated on how the treaty works. And especially in the US, I've talked to so many people who, after seeing the words or sentences like nukes are finally illegal, they think that America will now miraculously start to dismantle its nuclear arsenals. But that's simply not true. Mm-hmm. The treaty is in no way binding for the nuclear powers. So in this aspect, I'm afraid it isn't really changing much, sadly. Mm-hmm. This is just a whole, this is where I get lost with the treaty.
thank you for that. And yes, the whole idea, the narrative that this is a nuclear weapons ban is a bit overstated given the way that international law works. However, it's a norm. It's a norm that is being stated, being heard, and we're thinking about it. And I couldn't help, but recall in this country, so slavery is an abomination. Okay, it is just unacceptable. There's no factual, you could never justify it. However, when William Lloyd Garrison in 1831 issued the very first issue of his newspaper, The Liberator, he was ridiculed, attacked, assaulted. People laughed at him, but he had this idea that this is just really wrong. And I think that we're still, like, that idea, this is 1831 where he publishes this, way before the Civil War, 30 years before the Civil War. His vision is still being realized. We still have not come to his vision. We still have not come to the vision of a truly interracial democracy in the United States. Even when, and even if the, all countries ratify the Treaty for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, as we all know, implementation is always tricky. And so even in this country, we talked about Juneteenth, and the states were freed, the slaves were freed, and those in Texas still had slaves. And so the National Guard had to march in and say, you didn't get the memo. And so my point is, it takes a long time for a norm to trickle down into the actual consciousnesses of people. And that's what this treaty is doing. And I think the ICAN campaign, although it's overstating it a bit, as you said, Vonda, it's like, there's something really dynamic about this campaign. This is a campaign of young people all over the world. And there's something like just very sort of exciting about the energy in it. And my belief is it's kind of a no-brainer for the reasons that Taylor said. It's like, if we're really serious about, peace and human dignity and human rights, this is like a no-brainer, and consciousness will awaken and evolve, but it takes time. How specifically do we change the mindset of the nuclear weapon states? I think one person at a time. One conversation at a time. I'll stop there.
No, I couldn't agree more. When you're saying the great things take time, even, before TBNW, nuclear weapons were the only weapon of mass destruction that were not subject to a comprehensive ban. Mm-hmm. I think biological weapons were banned under the Biological Weapons Convention in 1972, I believe, then chemical weapons in 93, and the list goes on. So it's rather sad that it took us 75 years since they were first used to have a comprehensive ban in force. So in this way, it is very exciting, and we have waited for quite a long time for this. And actually, really in the fall, when there was a bit of a rise in the number of states ratifying, it was so great to just on social media, on Instagram, people celebrating the separate countries joining in and discussing the issue of nuclear weapons, even the people that would otherwise probably not really care. So you're absolutely right that ICAN is bringing a great level of awareness to the issue. Mm-hmm. And you are absolutely right that it is changing the narrative, which is amazing. I'm grateful for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this point that like nuclear weapons are the only weapon of mass destruction to not be banned. I mean, that right there sort of defies logic. And you know, as we've discussed, you know, the early Hague peace conferences, they're banning poisoned arrows and exploding bullets. And that was a sort of shocker to me. Like, why are we banning those weapons, which seem like not as horrible as nuclear weapons? And so it just, that fact itself also, you know, cries for logic. And again, it's like people aren't aware of it. But I think when people do become aware of these facts about the legality of nuclear weapons, about how they actually work, it's just like a no-brainer. But it takes time because, as we've said, we're just, a lot of people don't ever think about this at all. And yeah, ICANN is changing that very much. So anybody else on this point?
I would just like to second and say that I completely agree that the excitement and the energy, especially on the eve of the treaty entering into force, is so profound. And even to, you know, be able to Google search the treaty and to see news articles about high-ranking individuals from Pope Francis to other state leaders discussing and urging the world to move towards ratifying, other nations moving towards ratifying this treaty, is so very exciting. And I hope that through many different efforts that this momentum continues and we eventually do reach a time in place, whether it's another 75 years from now when they have truly been eliminated off the face of the earth.
Cool. And I also want to say that although the United States has not ratified the treaty, there are, you know, numerous activities going on in the United States today, tomorrow, and you can go to the ICANN website. It's icanw.org, and you can see all these events and amongst things that are happening. And there's like, that's one place where you can find events. Also the Women's International League of Peace and Freedom, which is the oldest women's peace organization in the world. Their U.S. chapter and members are organizing things all over the United States, including many actions involving you know, protests outside of businesses, companies that manufacture or design nuclear weapons. So there's a lot going on. So that's also part of the dynamism that we're talking about. Okay, so let's just move in. Vonda, do you want to say something?
No, sorry, just even that there is even small events happening in the Czech Republic, which is also hasn't signed or ratified. And as a NATO country, I doubt that it will. But even here, there is a petition going around and people are recognizing what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's just very exciting. So let's move to the actual articles of the treaty. So we've been talking about the preamble, which lays out the sort of letter and spirit and philosophy behind the treaty. The articles lay out the very specific duties of the signatories of the treaty. And these duties will be triggered tomorrow. These are when the duties go into effect. And so Vonda, we'll start with you.
All right. So if I were to choose one article from the whole treaty, I guess I'd go with Article 8, and that's the meeting of state parties. So in the treaty, they describe that the first meeting will be 1 year after the entry into force, then there will be biannual meetings, and then a review conference 5 years after entering force, and that's to monitor recent developments, the implementation of the treaty, and so on. So that's all pretty standard, but, and this is where I see another contribution, it opens up a lot of possibilities, and some of them we've touched upon last week as well. But first, possibilities for the civil society, which is where I'm happy. Mm-hmm. So, for example, the NPT Review Conference, there the civil society has a good chance in presenting their programs and solutions to the participants. Just this past year in 2020, before the conference got postponed, I was supposed to co-organize two events for the NPT, two side events. on one on behalf of Move the Nuclear Weapons Money, and then one on behalf of Youth Fusion to bring in the youth voices. But so it is good that they are also opening this up to other institutions, organizations. I think the treaty mentions the Red Cross and other important institutions, and that it is also allowing them to contribute and give them the chance to be there. And I really think that a lot of decisions and agreements happen in these somewhat informal settings, almost, of, you know, the side events and the snack times and coffee breaks. So having this there is, in my eyes, actually very beneficial on behalf of the civil society. And then the other side of the aisle, new possibilities for the state parties, that really these meetings then will give them the chance to take this treaty one step further and create a bigger impact of this treaty. And again, this is something that we've touched upon last week, but that they can adopt some implementation methods like the prohibiting of financing or the no-fly zones, which would then have real clear direct impact on the nuclear weapons state, which would actually limit their nuclear weapons related activities, like, well, the treaty does now itself. So though this is hypothetical and it hasn't been adopted, while I have certain reservations to the treaty, this Article 8 is giving me a lot of hope that we can take this even further, even on the legal level, not just the normative one, and really create a clear impact that will have consequences on the nuclear powers.
Yeah, and to the point about, like, it's like in these informal settings, like these coffees and where a lot of important work is done, a lot of important conversations happen. Yeah, that's absolutely recognized by Bertha von Suttner, that these spaces, right? So she creates her salon in the 1899 Hague Peace Conference, and that's, you know, outside of the plenary. And so, yeah, I think it's, you're around, you're being heard, you're part of the dialogue, the NGO community. So some of us on the call have some connection with the framework around the International Criminal Court and the meeting of the Assembly of States Parties. And it's like a similar thing, the Coalition for the International Criminal Court. It's like this umbrella organization of all the NGOs that support the ICC. And I've been to some of those meetings, and yeah, they're amazing because of the sort of conversations that you can have and the education that goes on. Anybody else want to follow up on Article 8 and what it will usher in?
I wonder if just the mere opportunity to have more diplomacy will cause more states to want to enter the treaty. And it's such a soft factor, but so many states have joined different bodies, it seems, just to have another avenue of diplomacy. However, I also worry about smaller states having the resources to send diplomats and representatives to these meetings, because I feel like so often with smaller states, they have more limited resources and therefore less influence for these treaty body meetings, because they can't hire anyone, or they don't have enough people to attend everything. So I agree with you that this is where the really valuable work happens, but I worry, you know, how they're going to make sure that smaller states who arguably have a bigger or more impacted by nukes oftentimes will be able to sort of advocate for themselves at these meetings.
This is a really, really good point. And I think it goes back to the narrative of it, because I feel like, coming from a very little country, I think small countries can have this feeling that they're irrelevant or that they can't really change anything because they don't have that much money, or because just they're small. But that goes back into the education. I think just a comparison, in the Czech Republic, because we are not as educated on what is going on, we don't really have the need to push on our governments to participate in these forums. So if we are really changing now the narrative on what nuclear weapons are, how dangerous they are, then the people should push on their governments more, and then the governments should act on that.
Mm. Cool. And I just want to add also that this distinction in governance, that, you know, some states are like have a democratic process and some states are more autocratic. That fact has been seized on by the United States as one of their arguments against the TPNW, that actually, like, because not every state is democratic and because the people don't have the say in every state, and in particular talking about Russia and China, this is a reason not to sign on to the TPNW. And in fact, it's a very dangerous conversation for another day. We can't solve it all here, but you know, point well taken. And I'll just move on to my article, which is very similar to the provision of the preamble that I talked about. And this is Article 1. And Article 1, like the sort of heading of it, is prohibitions. And there's a number of subsections to it. And I'm focused on subsection E. So 1E, which says, each state party undertakes never under any circumstances to assist, encourage, or induce in any way anyone to engage in any activity prohibited by a state party under this treaty. And then earlier in that prohibition article, they talk about you cannot develop, you cannot test, you cannot produce, you cannot manufacture, otherwise acquire, possess, or stockpile. So as I said before, when I was talking about the preamble, this is like never, never, ever, ever. And the assistance clause, I think, is really interesting because, as I mentioned before, and as you mentioned last time, Vonda, you know, these businesses involved in the design and manufacture of nuclear weapons, that means like you just, as a business, you can have nothing to do with this. You can have nothing to do with this. So this is the, like, if you interpret assistance this way. So if I'm designing nuclear weapons and I'm, my state is a party to this treaty, I can't do that anymore. And so this clause really, yeah, helps to totally eliminate anything nuclear. And so again, I can't tell, this is the way that my mind works. Like, it's just, we're just not going to allow anyone who has anything to do with it. You can't do it. So it's like, you know, child molesting or that kind of thing. Like, it's, we're just not going to allow you to do any kind of related business having to do with nuclear weapons. And that's of course a huge change. Anybody want to speak to Article 1 prohibition or 1E, you know, you can't assist, etc. It's pretty clear. So okay, so Michael, you have Article 6, I believe.
Yes, Article 6's heading is Victim Assistance and Environmental Remediation. And in the treaty itself, this is a very small article. It is 2 points outlining how nations, and Vonda and I kind of had a discussion about this during the last show in the context of Kazakhstan, of where does nation responsibility lie when your nation was affected and you've signed on to this treaty, but the nation that perpetrated the nuclear testing against you and has caused all the harm to the environment, where does that responsibility lie if they then haven't signed on to it? But I would say the reason I picked Article 6 is because I believe it helps that the TPNW also in this article recognizes that, and it is also touched on in the preamble as well, that the other major cause facing our time is the climate crisis. And the nuclear issue is also a climate issue. And because these weapons have the capability of literally poisoning the earth and all the inhabitants and life that exists in areas where these bombs go off. And through my various discussions with individuals within the environmental realm, we have been able to draw a lot of parallels between the nuclear issue and the environmental issue. That many people, when they first think of the nuclear issue, they view it as a purely political, it exists purely in the political realm, that it is one that involves international diplomacy and domestic politics to get anything done, and that is where it remains, that it's just like the national governments deciding amongst each other how this will end up going. But I think as I think Vonda had made this point in a couple shows ago that you can find your niche in the nuclear issue. If you're into environmental stuff, there is a place for you here. If you're into the political stuff, there's a place for you here. If you're into community building, there's a place for you in this issue. So the sheer broadness of it, I think, also speaks to the urgency that is needed to disarm them just from the sheer amount of destruction that that can be caused by having these weapons. And I think on the flip side, the environmental issue is in the climate crisis is also more than just a purely reduce, reuse, recycle ordeal. It is one that involves community sustainability, community development. How do we go about fostering a world in which we as people can live together in a way that is sustainable and in harmony with the world around us? And having nukes is contradictory to that end. And so, by having Article 6, which touches on, which I think is a really important point from the two places that we've touched on before that have had testing conducted, the Marshall Islands and Kazakhstan and various other places in the world, as Vonda said today, the French Polynesia and places in Africa that the French used for testing, that the nuclear issue encompasses is and resides within the realm of the climate crisis. And I think to properly address the climate crisis, you need to address the nuclear issue. And to properly address the nuclear issue as well is to also address the environmental issue. And that was, I think, a very important parallel to draw, that work is then being made in this realm as well.
And Vonda, I mean, Youth Fusion does work to really highlight that connection. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like we're with Michael on the same page here, that it's all so interconnected. In fact, yesterday or 2 days ago, we held this international forum, and there was this quote that went, climate change is a slow moving nuclear weapon, which that's so true and so sad. But no, it's so key to recognize these connections. And going back to the sustainable development goals recognized by the UN, the motto is to leave no one behind. So we really shouldn't be leaving any indigenous people, but also to leave none of the goals behind. So again, like, you can't, precisely as Michael said, you cannot just think about the climate and forget about nuclear weapons, because they're harming the environment so greatly. This is for a whole nother talk.
Yeah, let's do it at some point. Cool. Anybody else on the environment connection? So Taylor, you have Article 7, I believe.
Yes. And the specific clause, Clause 6, that I want to talk about actually addresses state party duties for the purposes of victim assistance and environmental remediation to affected state parties. And there are several interesting things about this clause. So it says, without prejudice to any other duty or obligation that it may have under international law, a state party that has used or tested nuclear weapons or any other nuclear explosive devices shall have a responsibility to provide adequate assistance to affected state parties for the purpose of victim assistance and environmental remediation. And the first thing that really sticks out to me is the idea that there's a duty, and it comes right after Article 6, which Michael just discussed. And it sort of reminded me of if there's a right, there is a duty. And there's also consequences to these nuclear explosive devices and nuclear weapons. So although the state party, you know, the U.S. isn't a state party, and we don't really have this hold on nuclear powers with the treaty, hopefully, as we discussed earlier, this becomes sort of a normative framework, and it can help be used by advocates to sort of say, well, you know, states have duties, right, to the victims of their nuclear weapons programs. And I also think the word victim to me really emphasizes the human element of these crimes. It's not really a crime against the states. I mean, it is a crime against the states, but it's also a crime against the people within the states. Mm-hmm. And so I know victim assistance is often collective, but to me, it really emphasized, like, this clause that what states are doing has consequences for people. And that states need to, you know, own up to those consequences and provide assistance to states to be able to ensure that their you know, their victims and their environment are, you know, not, or basically remedy the problems that they have created.
Yeah, and this treaty, I think they began, I think ICANN began working on this treaty in 2007, okay? And at that time, you know, there's a shift in the discourse about nuclear weapons, and the focus was on, as you're pointing out with like this word victim, but the focus was on the humanitarian, that's the language, that's the humanitarian consequences of these weapons and the disproportionate impact, the indiscriminate nature of the weapons, et cetera. And that's a sort of, philosophical shift on these weapons. And I think that, the article that you're talking about and your sort of gloss on it is underscoring that this is really about human beings, also about the environment, as we've been saying, and that if we focus on the impact to actual human beings, it's sort of a no-brainer that we have to get rid of these things. Anybody else on that point?
Yeah, I just quickly like to commend South Africa as the only country that built its own nuclear arsenal and then dismantled it for really standing up and cleaning up its own messes. Yeah. That's absolutely phenomenal in my eyes. And they've ratified. So I just wanted to mention this year. And I know we've mentioned it last week as well, but
yeah, here. Thank you, South Africa, for leading the way.
Yeah.
All right. So,
and also showing that it is possible to get rid of its own nuclear arsenal, dismantle it, and then try to move on now. It's a really great example. Mm. And again, I don't think we talk about that enough.
No, we don't. So yeah, I can't remember if it was on this show that this point was made, but it's expanding our moral imagination, right? That when we see South Africa do such a thing, that sort of shows us what's possible, and that affects how we can imagine ourselves, et cetera. Cool. And to round out the show, we're coming to an end. We just wanted to highlight, there's a lot, right? The treaty is a lot. We could spend several shows just talking about the Non-Proliferation Treaty versus the Treaty for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. We have not gone through all of the preamble. We have not gone through all of the articles. So we've only highlighted some things. But the other thing that there's a lot to digest is the website of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. You can access it on our show resources page and, you know, roam around for a little bit. And so we just wanted to go around and share some things that stuck out, highlight some things, and we'll start with Taylor.
So there is a briefing on the website on emerging technologies and nuclear weapon risks, and it's not that long, but it highlights some very concerning points about why we really need non-proliferation and the risk of nuclear weapons in light of sort of new developments and new reliance on artificial intelligence and machinery in the nuclear weapon space. And so I had always conceived of the sort of the problems with technology and nuclear weapons to being, you know, hacks or whatnot. But as we have begun to rely, and as different military programs rely more and more on artificial intelligence, we start to rely as humans more and more on these technologies to make our decisions. And fortunately, we've been in a case where humans have been involved in, you know, sort of nuclear weapon decision-making type things, because there's still some humanity that exists. But if we remove the human element, we have a problem. And one of the situations that this briefing describes is that there have been false positives that humans have seen the machines saying, you know, there's a nuclear weapon coming, you know, to the United States, for example. And humans are like, this doesn't seem right. You know, the machines are clearly saying that this is right, but I'm not going to, you know, do the standard procedural response. basically preventing a potential nuclear catastrophe if, you know, you then respond with a nuclear weapon, because it says that this artificial intelligence is telling you. And as we've grown in technology, because we've become more reliant, it's possible that human decision making is going to become less and less relevant, and we'll be taking out the humanity in our nuclear, our decision making about military, and in particular nuclear weapons, which when it comes to nuclear weapons would basically mean the end of the world potentially. So like it's almost, to me, it highlighted that it's necessary even more so than in the past, just because we're more at risk due to an accident, even the more that we've taken humans out of it.
Yeah. And I did link on their show resources page, the chilling film about one of these mistakes. It's called The Man Who Saved the World, and you can watch that. It's on YouTube for free. And it's a true story in the 80s, how a Russian who had designed the system realized that he was using his, as you're talking about, Taylor, his like humanity, and he's not following the protocol, and he's going with his intuition and not obeying protocol. And it's a chilling story. So check out the film. You know, it's a nice way to privately celebrate the entry into force of the treaty tomorrow. So there it is for you on the show resources page. Anybody else want to speak about that? Like the reliance on automation and AI, and Fonda?
Just a quick comment on the movie. I'm a big fan, and we've actually done a couple of screenings with Youth Fusion and Pride Vision and other organizations. You know, the saddest part from the whole story for me is that after that happened, after he legitimately saved the world, he got kicked out of the army. And he spent the rest of his life pretty much alone and without any recognition whatsoever. So just the fact that he did this amazing thing and it wasn't recognized, and they were angry at him for doing that, basically, for not following the orders, even though he proved that the orders were wrong and that the system was wrong. That just shows how crazy the system was/is?
Yeah, it's a really good film. I think it was made by a Danish filmmaker, but anyway, check it out. It's on our show resources page, and yes, it is a sad story. A similar thing happened to Oppenheimer, you know, who designed the nuclear weapon. He started to speak out against it, and he was, you know, ostracized by the U.S. government. So Michael, go ahead with what's interesting about the ICANN website to you.
Yeah, and then thank you all for talking about like the Stanislav Petrov story. I think if anything really exemplifies and personifies the absolute madness of nuclear weapons, that it literally came down to one individual who I think you could rightly say saved the world from utter annihilation, it would be that incident. So no, definitely go check it out. But yes, for me, what my favorite, or one of the parts of the ICANN website, which I thought all of it was absolutely amazing, and I would encourage anyone interested in finding maybe an entry point into this issue in which to educate yourself, or you know, you just want to learn more, to go check out the ICANN website. There's a lot of really great resources and information on there. But one of my favorite sections of the website was the one that highlighted the 9 nuclear nations. And this is a point that we have, I think, reiterated in the series before, but as we have also said before, it takes multiple passes to truly come to understand something. And so then if this has been reiterated, allow this to be another pass. But I think, as Vonda has said and others, that people really aren't cognizant of how many weapons really are out there. And so I thought the section that talked about the 9 nuclear armed states had a lot of really awesome visuals to just show you how many weapons there truly are. And according to the ICANN website, there's 13,400 warheads in the world. And I also found it really illuminating because many people don't think about nations hosting nuclear weapons of the United States. And so Turkey, nations such as Turkey, Italy, Belgium, Germany, and the Netherlands all host more than upwards of 20 nuclear warheads of the United States is. And so just to show you how far reaching these weapons are and where they are embedded in the world. And I think for anyone who was not cognizant of this, this is a really stark visual to show just how many warheads there actually are. And there is this, one of the scientists, Carl Sagan, from the 1980s, when they were discussing the possibility of nuclear winter, and he had this really great analogy of, like, think of the world as a room doused in gasoline, and one side has 2,000 matches and you have 2,000 matches, and each side is concerned with who has more matches, when in reality all it takes is just one match, and one match equaling one nuclear weapon. And it just shows that for there to be over 13,000 is just utterly alarming, and it just speaks to the urgency of why this treaty needs to enter into force, and then the efforts that need to be made to ensure that the nuclear armed states do begin to work to disarm and to eventually completely annihilate all of the weapons that they have in their stockpiles.
And Vonda, and if I recall, you talked about on one of the shows how when, you know, young people learn about how other European countries are hosting nuclear weapons, it's kind of like, you know, a wake-up call, and we need to stop that. Is that, am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah, absolutely. It's like the sound of a mirror shattering. Mm-hmm. That's what happens in everyone's heads. Mm-hmm. No, but speaking of those revelation when you discover what's going on around you. Another project that ICANN's doing is the Don't Bank on the Bomb, which is actually a PAX project, but they're doing it in conjunction with ICANN. And it's basically a research on the private companies involved in the production of nuclear weapons and also their financiers. So it's a very good resource. And because last week we talked about moving nuclear weapons money and how individuals can contribute nuclear divestment. So Don't Bank on the Bomb is a really good source of information for further action, such as nuclear divestment. And it's just browsing through their reports, it's illuminating to discover where nuclear weapons are and you know, how many, what Michael is saying. And now you can see what corporations profit from them. And it gets even worse in your head. Mm-hmm. It's very, very eye-opening. So that is a really good research project to check out if you're interested in this.
Thanks for that. And I'll add my, what sort of stuck out to me on the site. And the site is really great. Again, there's so much information. They did a report in 2019 called Schools of Mass Destruction, American Universities in the U.S. Nuclear Weapons Complex. And they list a number of different universities. One is in Michigan. I'm not going to say which one it is. It's not Central Michigan University. But these are universities that conduct research that supports nuclear weapon systems, et cetera, and at various levels. And the campaign encourages students at those universities to get involved. And so if you're interested in that, and the discussion about Don't Bank on the Bomb and these businesses that we've talked about and universities, the other thing that, you know, the campaign highlights as this, it's a philosophical issue, it's also a moral issue, responsibility. And that goes back to the assistance clause, right? So you can't assist in any way these systems. And I just think that's a profound point, that the view of responsibility here is very, very broad. So the financing, the profiting, the research, and it needs to be, we need to have a sense of that. There have been other campaigns, like conflict minerals and so forth, supply chain ethics, being mindful about where we're sourcing our materials, is, you know, are child soldiers involved, etc. And so that kind of mindfulness is being brought to bear on the nuclear weapons issue. And I think that's really great. So at this point, we've been going for about an hour, and we'll just go around and sort of close out the eve of the entry into force of the Treaty for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, a very historic moment in my view. I liken it to something like the very first issue of William Lloyd Garrison's The Liberator, because and I have the very first issue. He says, quote, "I do not wish to think, speak, or write with moderation. I am in earnest. I will not equivocate. I will not excuse, and I will not retreat a single inch, and I will be heard." I think so. That's 1831, and I think that this treaty reminds me of that kind of spirit. And so the treaty is making a statement, and it will be heard. And we'll just go around, and we'll start with Taylor, go to Michael, and then end with Vonda.
So it's interesting you compared those two, because I was thinking during this conversation that it sort of reminded me of, and maybe this might be an exaggeration, like slightly different, but the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and mm-hmm. how that was non-binding to any states, but it eventually became customary law, and it sort of became this like explosion of basically a human rights framework that people and advocates point to and sort of has become the foundation. And, you know, this is a very particular topic and a very particular point, but I think this is, although it's only been accepted by several states, if you can get the people to support it, I almost wonder if you can get sort of this normative, like you've been discussing, this normative force behind it for it to become customary law. If other states start to follow it, even though they're not a treaty signatory to it or have ratified it, I wonder if you can sort of get this sort of the magic of the UDHR in terms of nuclear weapons, because I think that's something that was missing early on in sort of UN human rights documents. They never mentioned sort of the right to be free of nuclear weapons, which I think is hopefully a normative shift that can occur.
Cool. Michael?
Thank you. I would definitely agree with the William Lloyd Garrison comparison. I would just say that I think this week especially is one that I have felt carries immense resonance in the United States. On Monday, January 18th, it was Martin Luther King Day. On the 20th, yesterday, we inaugurated the United States' 46th president. And then tonight is the eve of the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons going into effect tomorrow. So I think you can just, for me personally, I feel the resonance of the moral energy throughout this week. And it has been very uplifting and very inspiring that you can feel that this marks the beginning of something. And that even though, as Hope had made the comparison to slavery and the time that had passed from when William Lloyd Garrison first wrote his piece to when the Emancipation Proclamation was eventually signed, that even though the effects of this treaty, you know, once it goes into effect tomorrow, the next day, all the nuclear armed states are not going to be dismantling their arsenals. But to feel that resonance is that today marks the beginning of something. And then I think as time goes on and as more people become cognizant and are educated of this issue, we will see the fruits bear of the seed that has been planted. And I think we as a global community will be so much better of it. And I would just once again reiterate to Vonda Taylor and you, Hope, thank you so much for an amazing 3 weeks of this conversation, and it has been an honor to hear all of your thoughts and inputs, and especially for you, Vonda, for coming and sharing all of your moral energy with us all. It has been a true pleasure, and I've been honored to be a part of this conversation.
No, coming on last, it's very hard to follow up. No, but I would just like to say that I wouldn't like to neglect all the hard work that has already been done before. Mm. You know, there has been a progress in this field, and all states are bound by customary international law requiring nuclear disarmament by the very first UN General Assembly resolution, which was adopted by consensus 75 years ago and focused precisely on nuclear disarmament. So this new treaty is an amazing contribution. But then no first use would be another, or nuclear weapons free zones are another great legal tool to help us achieve our goals. And in fact, half the world already is nuclear weapons free, which is me looking at the half full glass. But so our role here is to talk about these issues more, to keep educating ourselves and then others. So I would sincerely like to thank you, Hope, Michael, Taylor, Randy, who was here last week, for contributing to this issue. It's been an absolute pleasure to be here for the 3 weeks. And exactly what Michael was saying, just look at what has happened just within the 3 weeks. So I too have a good feeling about where we're headed. So once again, thank you for having me. Take care and stay well.
Thank you, Vonda. And I'll just add, you know, the what happens in a week is a lot, but also what happens in 190 years is a lot. And, you know, William Lloyd Garrison, 1831, he says, "I will be heard." I would say even up till today, we're still dealing with the effects of slavery and racism and inequality. It's 190 years later. It's been 100 years since women have been enfranchised in the United States with a political voice. And so that's also adding to the speed at which we're seeing these more humane measures. And so, like, to all of you, Vonda, Taylor, Michael, and Randy, who sadly cannot join us today, it's always a pleasure to speak with you, to dialogue with you, and to learn from you. Socrates said, "The greatest good of man is daily to converse about virtue." That was actually our slogan for Ethics Talk, the first iteration of this podcast series that we began over 10 years ago. And so there's something very much gained in dialogue about meaningful and important things with others. So we will be back soon. You've been listening to Virtues of Peace. Please take a moment sometime tomorrow to further educate yourselves about the treaty, the ICANN campaign, etc. Check out our show resources page at virtuesofpeace.com. Thank you and good evening. Bye-bye.